from the Sky News Centre at 6. The first funerals for some of the victims of the bridge collapse in Italy are being held in Naples. The ceremony is taking place for four young men who were on their way on holiday. 38 people have been confirmed dead in the tragedy and 20 more could still be missing. Ciro Bolognese is one of the firefighters involved in searching the rubble.
The search activity is made with K9, so with dogs and with micro camera to try to assess the voids in the debris.
At least 324 people are dead after flooding in India, which officials say is the worst in a century. There have been 10 days of monsoon rains in the southern state of Kerala. Around 250,000 people are currently living in relief camps after fleeing their homes. Shantalma is one of them.
When water came in, we ran away with whatever we could grab. The water came very fast. We had to save our lives. We lost so many things.
House of Fraser, which was bought by Sports Direct last week, has apologised after cancelling all online orders. New documents also show the chain owes creditors like Armani, Diesel and Prada over £480 million. A teenager who stabbed a Syrian refugee in a frenzied attack has been jailed for more than 7 years. Shabazz Ali was left with life-threatening injuries after 18-year-old Sean Gorman stabbed him 6 times in an Edinburgh hostel. Family and close friends of Barry Chuckle have attended his funeral in Rotherham. His brother Paul carried his coffin as fans lined the streets outside the New York Stadium in the Yorkshire town. In sport, Danny Cipriani's been charged by the Rugby Football Union after being convicted of assault over an incident in Jersey this week. He will face a disciplinary hearing next week. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Advertise your business right here. We're Bristol's most diverse radio station and double Sony Gold Award winners. Who else can say that? Reach Bristol's changing demographic by using a local ethical charity that's here for you. Radio advertising works, especially when you're as trusted as we are. Log on to bcfmradio.com. For more details,
BCFM Radio reserve the right to refuse advertising from payday loan companies and other businesses that we consider unethical. Email sales at bcfmradio.com for more details. Click on the BCFM Radio website today for a special 25% discount.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news as Labour councillor for Avonmouth and Lawrence Weston, Joe Sargent, also from the Counter Colston Group, former teacher Christine Townsend. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, so to Turkey, which seems to be further from NATO every day, while all the focus is on a little-known US pastor arrested after the US coup attempt 2 years ago. What and who is really behind this latest breakdown in relations some are calling economic warfare? Also, if privatisation since Margaret Thatcher has been such an economic disaster for the nation, perhaps the money had nothing to do with it. What was the real reason for privatisation in the 1980s? We get the lowdown from John Kay, who was director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies at the time. Also, we seem to be starting a series of Get to Know the Israeli Cabinet. Last week, it was Justice Minister Eilat Shaked. This week, it's Homeland Security Minister Gilad Erdan, who explains what he believes is the logic behind his anti-terror strategy. And further east, we look at mind control and extreme surveillance in China, which is overtaking the UK as the world's big brother state with so many cameras. Also, the slow crushing of free speech in Hong Kong while the Chinese military do their biggest exercises ever off the coast there. This week, the UN criticised China's so-called re-education camps, which are trying to wean a million of China's mainly Muslim Uyghurs off the Quran and onto President Xi's Little Red Book. plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows are around 16 Celsius, dry though. This weekend, highs around 21, mainly cloudy with a moderate breeze and no rain, hopefully. Well, hopefully, that's not really good enough, is it? No rain. I'll have to say that, because that's what the forecast is. Next week, highs of 22, sunny spells and breezy at times. Next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of August, highs of 21, some sunny spells and a bit breezy. Still not a lot of rain, though, is there? So, helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Avonmouth, Lawrence Weston, Joe Sargent. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Can you just tell us a little bit about you? I think it's the first time you've been on, is it?
Yes.
It is. Could you tell us about what got you into politics and why the Labour Party?
When I was a lot younger, I was a member of the Labour Party, and in the 1980s, and a few things happened which sort of made me decide I didn't want to be a member of the Labour Party anymore.
Go on, what was that then?
I think probably, although I was still a member at the time, but it sort of had a bit of a lasting effect, was the way Labour behaved during the miners' strike. And also the sort of witch hunts that took place in the 80s. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't a big fan of militant, but I didn't like the way they treated them.
No, right, okay. So I think it might be useful. We're going to talk about it in the second hour. It might be interesting to bring that piece from John Kay forward into the first hour so you can comment on that as well, because he was one of the people who was giving all the advice to the country and the government about privatisation during the 1980s. And he's had some quite interesting things to say. So we'll do that in a little while. But anyway, so why Labour? Why not another party?
Well, I don't know. I think it was instinctive. It felt right to me. Because I did have a little dabble with the Greens quite a while ago, but I just didn't feel, I don't know, they're just, the connection wasn't there.
So how come back in the Labour Party? When did you rejoin?
I actually joined straight after the 2015 election result, but before the Jeremy Corbyn announced his candidature.
What about your background? What's professionally, what have you been up to?
Well, I started out working in casinos many years ago. It was just a job that I happened to go into, and I knew it wasn't going to last forever. So I ended up training to be a librarian. So I went from a casino to a library, which is a bit odd, I know.
It's interesting. What's your take on what's been going on with the libraries here? Because we've had a nail-biting 18 months or so, haven't we?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is I get Marvin's position where he says that we have to make certain choices because we haven't got enough money. But I just think we could do more with what we've got if we think about it in a more clever way. We can do more with our services, including our libraries, and that's one of the things that I've been working on.
What sort of reception have you got? I mean, it does look as if they may have been saved. Do you know what's the actual, from the council, what's the actual line? Have the libraries been saved? If so, how long?
I mean, from a purely a financial point of view, the £1.4 million that was supposed to be being taken out of the library's budget is not being taken out of the library's budget. That's all there is at the moment, and everything's continuing to run as it was before. But there are going to have to be changes, because we can't sustain what we've got, and we need to get more people into using the library
so
service.
So will we still have libraries in, say, 5 years' time? If so, what will they look like?
Well, if I have my way, we will definitely have libraries. I would hope that we would have at least as many libraries as we've got now. I'm not a fan of closing down libraries in communities, but we might have to look at how we can pool resources, sort of consolidate. So, for example, where we've got a standalone library building that's delivering nothing but a library service, we might have to look at ways of bringing in other services there so that we can get more people to use the building. And, we can... It's just a sort of... I suppose it just makes some economic sense, really.
Well, do you have any truck with the argument that libraries have had their day?
Well, I think it depends on what you define as a library. I mean, a place where you have to sit quietly and where you just borrow books and you sit quietly and you get shushed at by a librarian, that's well and truly gone. But actually, as a community space for local people to come to, where they don't have to pay to use the service, where they can actually find information and reading material that's going to stimulate them and help keep their brain going, I can't see how anyone could say that libraries have had their day.
But isn't that the internet now?
No, it isn't. I think in the end, I mean, you look at a young child and you see, okay, yeah, they like screens and they like watching, but they also love books and they love being read to. And they like the social experience, and all adults as well, actually, when you give them the chance, enjoy the social experience of reading together.
Well, I must say, I mean, I still feel there's nothing like an actual proper book to read, a novel or whatever. Mm. Martin Summers, I know you're quite a big user of the library service, but actually, you know, maybe you could be considered a Luddite, where actually you're just in the way of the technology, which is moving towards e-books and that sort of thing.
Well, I think I'm a big library user, but I use the central library because they've got all the books that I want to read, and I think there is an issue that if you think about it, all local authorities by 2020 are going to be in a position where they're probably only able to afford statutory stuff, which is basically what's happened with Northamptonshire, where all they can provide, and they can't even do that, is stuff for vulnerable children and elderly people. And I think people haven't really understood that what the Tories are planning to do is basically abolish local government. And there was an article, a letter in The Guardian the other day saying, well, there's not much point electing people to carry out this statutory stuff. There's no scope for any decisions to be taken. And I think, I'm afraid, that we're still living in the era where people imagine that the local authority can do stuff which ultimately it won't be able to do unless we change the government nationally.
And you were nodding there, Joe. Why haven't you and Marvin been making more of a fuss about this? As I don't think most of the electors know, or voters know, that this is the plan, to just shut down local government.
Well, me and Marvin, we're not like a kind of, you know, we're not joined at the hip. So what Marvin does is different, and he obviously has a different audience to me. But in my ward, I talk all the time about austerity and how it's affecting people. And I bang on about it on social media. And, you know,
what about the fact that we just run out of money?
Well, that's just stupid, really, I'm afraid.
Calling me stupid. Okay.
Sorry.
Well, yes, but I mean, that's the argument we hear all the time.
How
do you answer it?
You don't run out. I mean, you know, it's like, I suppose if you believe in God, it's a bit like saying God's run out of making power. You know, in the end, we're a government. We're a nation. We're a sovereign nation. We print, you know, we can print our own money. And it's just total nonsense.
So, Martin, why don't they do it?
Well, the fact is that the austerity agenda says that there's no money, but of course the money has been spent. It was spent on propping up the banks, and it all ended up in the Cayman Islands. But that's our money. And the decision to bail the banks out was not a market decision, it was a political decision. So the asset prices of the wealthy, like Jacob Rees-Mogg, have been propped up by government intervention. Meanwhile, our libraries have got to close. But there's no reason for that. It's a political decision.
Well, I did say we might go and have a listen to John Kay, and I think we'll do that now. He is the former head of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. I did an interview with him, which will be coming on to our Dialects show on Tuesdays at noon in a couple of weeks' time. But I thought he had some quite fascinating things to say about the real reasons behind privatisation, because he admitted to me, I don't think it's in this piece, but he said it's actually, you know, not actually very good for the economy, privatisation. So why did they do it? He was there at the time. Let's see what John Kay has to say.
In the 1970s, the Conservatives in opposition, they knew that the previous Conservative government from 1970 to 1974 had been destroyed by the unions and particularly the miners, and they were determined that that wouldn't happen again. So privatisation became in large part a way of curtailing the power of public sector trade unions. That was how it was envisaged. And it was envisaged in that way by some of the people who were advising Conservative Party as it was in opposition, of which Keith Joseph was one. And the result of that was, well, we all know about what happened in the mining industry, the appointment of McGregor, the miner strikes, and so on, ending effectively with the defeat of the miners in 1985, and basically the running down to zero of the coal industry, which followed from that. It's sort of the same thing in steel, where the government helped provoke and set out a strike, and then having done that, was able to sell off the steel industry. And again, it's been a similar story, that the steel industry has been pretty gradually run down as a result of that.
So that's John Kay, who was the Institute for Fiscal Studies director in the 1980s. Martin, provoke the strike in the steel industry and in the coal industry. Is that something you understand? That's what he's saying.
That's pretty accurate. I mean, I have come across John Kay before. He used to advise various Labour leaders. Yes, I mean, it's basically political. These decisions are not based on some kind of economic logic, really. They're basically political decisions to break the power of organised labour and to move us towards a more, an economy which is friendlier to the owners of assets than it is to the earners of wages.
But isn't it a bit reckless to deliberately provoke a national coal strike or a national steel strike?
It is, but they did it. With all of the consequences that follow. I mean, Britain's been deindustrialised during this last 30 years, quite deliberately. And, of course, when the next crash comes, and it will come, we will find that we actually haven't got loads of resources which we should have had to help us deal with the consequences of what's gone before. And I'm afraid if you do stupid stuff for 30 years, you end up in a bit of a cul-de-sac.
Were any of these industries actually able to turn a profit under public ownership?
Well, I used to teach A-level economics, and one of the exam questions which we used to teach was, what should have happened with the coal industry? And in actual fact, if you take into account the on costs of redundancy for the miners, the effects on the communities and so on, it makes sense, even if you're going to run it down, to run it down slowly and to allow people to adapt to a new circumstances. But of course, if you smash it all in one big festival of reaction, then of course you end up with Grimethorpe as the heroin capital of Yorkshire and no work there and so on, and that's what happens.
Joe, what do you make of all this?
I think you're right. The other thing I would have said about it was that, I mean, I agree about the winding down. I think there probably was a case for effectively gradually decommissioning the coal industry in this country. But as far as I know, all they did was replace it with imported coal.
That's right.
So they didn't actually achieve anything, because the main argument for getting rid of mining was because it's fossil fuel and it's bad for our environment. But we're still using it, and we're still using other fossil fuels
as well.
Well,
they seemed quite happy to pump out North Sea oil instead, didn't they? Anyway, what do you make of the... because the most, I suppose, modern thing that most people have come across, particularly parents, is these academy schools and the way they've been privatised. Now, that actually was begun by Labour. Wasn't it?
Yeah. I wasn't a member of that Labour Party.
Do you think that's worked?
No, I don't think it has worked. I'm not entirely sure the original academies were set up to deal with, as far as I know, they were set up to deal with failing schools, and it was a way of increasing resources where they were. I'm not 100% sure about this, and I didn't have any children at the time, so I wasn't having a sort of personal experience of them. But it just seemed to me that it was just another opportunity to give... It's just a marketisation of the education system. And also, it was about taking power away from local government. I think it's nearly always these decisions about public services are taking power away from local government.
But what about as a mum, and with other mums, chatting to other mums, what's your and their experience of it, do you think?
I think the problem is that... I am what I am. I've come. I would argue I'm fairly middle class. You know, I'm not. It's not like by choice. It's just what I am. And the people that I meet tend to be like that. And they aren't actually all that bothered a lot of the time, because they just see the benefits they get out of it. So, for example, the free school over in BS10 that was set up in an area where a lot of people. With kids in the local area can't go, because it's meant to be for people from BS9. I mean, that's absolutely scandalous in my view. But the people whose children go to that school are probably perfectly happy, because they think they're getting something good out of it, because they've managed to get a school that they want, a type of education that they want for their children without having to pay for it.
Now, Christine Townsend, I suppose if you've been excluded, you don't know what you don't get or what you haven't got.
No, and I think most parents, until it's actually in their face and it's their school, they're not actually necessarily looking. And It's about the politicians, and it's about those of us working in education and the governors and head teachers beginning to expose what is going on, because parents are bringing up their children, and you know they've got normal, you know they've got to go about their daily lives, and most parents, what they want for their children is a local school that's going to give their kids a good schooling. And it's not about who runs it necessarily or what structures are in place, but there has been an obsession with changing the structures, particularly since the coalition. I mean, Labour did bring in the first city academies. Absolutely, they did. And they were for the inner city. They were, that was the idea. It was inner city schools. They were so say failing, and it was about bringing in some funding that would mean that children could have a building that was fit for purpose, because at the end of the 90s the schools were literally, there were buckets in classrooms because the roofs were leaking. I mean, our school system in the 1990s was literally falling apart. And that did have an impact on how parents therefore saw academies, because they were a bit like, oh, look at that swanky school down the road. It's just been rebuilt. They've got the new IT systems. But what we've seen in Bristol is most of our investment now is finished with the academies. And what we're actually seeing is the old system that was fall back into place, so that we've got this kind of two-tier, those who know the system and can work the system, both from the family's perspective, but also importantly from the perspective of those who run the schools. They can play it, they can fiddle it so that it looks better for them. And those that can't and don't have that knowledge and don't take that time out, haven't got access to the books in the library or the internet at home, they're basically left with the places at the schools where those that are more affluent choose not to apply to.
Sounds like a sort of law of survival of the fittest is coming into education, which doesn't sound great. But Martin Summers, I know you've worked in both types, the sort of local authority run and the academy schools. Is there a different sort of working atmosphere, flavour in both?
There is, yes. Well, I mean, with academies, it very much depends on who's running the academy. So I worked for Oasis at one stage, and they were very strongly pushing all of this, what you might call evangelical Christianity, of a very unobjectionable kind. But really, not really. Why should the government pay for that? And of course, the local authority schools, you wouldn't necessarily find that unless they were run by the churches. And I think what's happening, as Christine says, is there used to be a division between the schools for poor people and the schools for rich people. I mean, secondary modern schools were definitely for those who were going to be hewers of wood and drawers of water. Grammar schools were for those who were going to university and into managerial classes. But what's happened now is more pernicious, because it really has become a dog's breakfast, where certain parents with sharp elbows can get more resources for their kids. And of course, kids that don't have the parents to push for that, or perhaps are in care or whatever, they end up going to the sink schools. And my dad used to be a head teacher in secondary schools when in the 1980s, when all this was brought in. And of course, once you've got to people not going to the local school, which is their local school, you've then got a situation where some schools become oversubscribed. They then get more resources because they're oversubscribed, and the schools which are undersubscribed get less resources. So you've then spiralling down, and the schools which are popular spiralling up, and somebody's kids have to go to the schools which the other kids don't want, the other parents don't want their kids to go to. And we're still failing many of our less academic children, as we always have.
So, Christine, I know you're also involved in this Counter Colston thing, which does, I mean, there's quite a lot of focus on the merchant venturers. This is this big organisation up in Clifton, which has been running the city. I don't know if they like me saying that, but they seem to own a large portion of the city and have a great deal of influence. And I wonder what you make of Colin Skellett recently. He's he's a merchant venturer and also chair of the Merchants Academy. I notice also that he's one of the people behind this new arena project in Filton.
Well, I'd like to ask Colin Skellett how he thinks that having an arena in Filton is going to benefit the children of the Merchants Academy in Hartcliffe.
But I mean, hasn't he just been employed to do that completely separately?
I don't care why he's been employed. I mean, you know, this man is the chair of a state school, and these people put themselves forward to improve the lot of South Bristol by taking on this school. So how is it, Colin Skellett, that Avenon Arena in Filton is going to benefit those children?
Well, I'll tell you what, Christine, I'll invite him next
Absolutely.
Week.
Absolutely. Get our come on with Colin Skellett or anybody else from the Merchant Venturers involved in running our schools.
What's the character of the schools or the main schools run by the merchants these days then, Christine?
Character? What do you mean character?
Well, what are they, you know, sort of, what? Which schools are they?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we've got the Merchants Academy in South Bristol, and officially they also run Colston Girls. They've got Dolphin, which is next door to it. And a couple of others, Barton Hill, they run, Bannerman Road and Kingfisher. But a merchant venture is also involved in running the Cathedrals Trust. He's the chair of the Cathedral Trust. And at one time in 2008, when the Cathedral and Colston's came into the state sector and merchants became a thing, as it was Withywood before, they were also running City Academy, and this has been long forgotten. And City Academy had Bannerman Road as its primary, and then when City Academy was within the space of about 3 months, Ofsted said it's inadequate and they were done for institutionalised racism, they offloaded City Academy onto the CLF, but they kept Bannerman Road, which is quite interesting because that school was considered to be good. And, you know, the Merchants Academy in the South is inadequate. Ofsted have told us it's inadequate.
What about Locklees? Because I know Marvin was about a month ago saying that there's a wonderful new school being built up there. I didn't catch from his speech, though, who would be running it. Do we know?
Yeah, so, well, it's the Cathedral Trust, so it's the merchant venturer that's kind of heading that up. What's interesting about this Locklees school, though, is that regardless of what Marvin's been told or what they're telling Anna Keane, the education lead, there are very few local children to get places there. It's going to be like the free school, and a priority is going to be given to children that live in BS1, which is central Bristol, because apparently there's a shortage of secondary school places in central Bristol in BS1, and that's where the Cathedral School has got its school, its original school. But it doesn't, and the reason there's a shortage is because that school doesn't serve local kids. It serves about 4 local authority areas by random allocation. Mm. And now it's going to solve the problem it's created, thank you, by building another school in Locklees that children from BS1 can then go to. But, of course, only if they can pay the cost of the transport to Locklees. If you haven't got the cost, you ain't going.
Well, I mean, the thing with the merchant venturers is they seem to have a lot of lines into cash, getting money to do this and that. So surely they're actually quite good people to be in charge of our schools.
Well, the money is state money. Schools are still built by central government and local. I mean, you know, it's taxpayers' money. It's our money. It is not money that belongs to the merchant venturers or the Cathedral's Trust. This is their philanthropic arm. This is their we're giving back to the community arm, so that you don't look at who run. You don't ask Colin Skellett why it is that he thinks it's a good idea to have the arena in Filton.
The other thing that happens often when things are privatised is that they become less transparent. I mean, have you found it reasonably easy to get information about how our merchant academies and other academy schools are run?
Well, I know where to go to get the publicly available documentation. Most people wouldn't know that.
Where?
Right. But
is it a secret?
No, it's not a secret, but you need to know where to go, or you need to know what you're looking for. And most people are just simply not in a position to be able to do that because they don't know what they're looking for and they don't know where to go to find the information.
So where is it?
Well, a lot of it is on government websites. You'll find a lot of it on the schools themselves websites or the trust websites. Or you look in the minutes from the trust boards, you know, or you look on Companies House and you trace down people's names and you do cross-referencing, that kind of thing, which takes time and energy and all that kind of stuff. But there is huge amounts of information that you will not have access to. So you'd have to use a Freedom of Information request or something like that in order to find that out.
Well, that's a bit irritating. What about this SEND cuts fiasco? What does SEND stand for? S-E-N-D.
Special educational needs. I'm not sure what the D is.
Is that disability?
Disability, yeah. I mean, I'm not entirely sure because I don't know the ins and outs of it. I do know that the LGA have piped up as well
Local Government Association.
Because they're, I think as far as they're aware, they're going to be quite a lot of these. This is going to be happening up and down the country because I think what's happened in Bristol is sort of changed, you know, set a bit of a precedent. I don't know. I'll be honest. I'm a backbencher. I don't know the ins and outs of the situation. But as far as I'm aware, there was a hole. There was a possibly George, maybe even before George, hole in the budget
for special needs kids.
I'm not entirely sure. As far as I know, it's the education. I don't want to put the blame on somebody else. I mean, clearly something's gone wrong here, but it's not. I think some of this is a bit sensitive, so I don't have all the information.
Okay. Christine, what do you make of this? Because I mean, you would think that would be a major priority, actually making sure that children with special needs got proper education. And there wasn't an attempt to sort of pretend they didn't have those special needs, lump them in with all the other children and just cross your fingers and hope that they learn things.
Yeah, I mean, I sit on the school. I'm the vice chair of the Schools Forum, which is a statutory body that said to Anna Keane, we are advising you not to make these cuts. And there's been a bit of an issue around whether that was passed on or not.
Seems to be a bit of an issue with the current administration. They say, oh, well, we didn't get the message. Like, you know, come to this committee meeting, that sort of thing, looking at the arena. Marvin says, oh, I never got the message to come. You know, that sort of thing. So maybe communications at the mayor's office. You need to have some loudspeakers.
Well, I mean, for me, working back home as long as I've been doing, it is very complicated. The way in which education is funded is very, very complicated. And I've been sitting on the Schools Forum for about 5 years, and I've just about got my head around how all the different funding streams work. So I'm not surprised that officers are in a position to just kind of hoodwink our elected representatives. But then what I would say to the political parties is that you need to make sure then that you've got people that are being elected that understand these systems, because in the end the officers are looking at the money, because it will be them that will be out.
Well, I've spent about 8 months trying to even get Anna Keane to answer the telephone or I'll reply to emails or anything. Can't get any response from her at all.
I mean, the thing, you know, I mean, well, I mean, I don't know how...
Invited her on here, you know, just nothing.
But what I would say, it's like she's a teacher, so therefore she could be the education, you know, the lead for education. It is a bit like saying, I can drive a bus, therefore I can, you know, repair all the problems, and I'm going to make some, you know, technological changes in order to make sure that it runs better. They're completely different things, and whilst you might understand some of the language, it will take you a long time, probably longer than Marvin's got left in his current mayoralship before that. And you know, and then who knows who might get in and who might then take the education lead. But there does need to be a huge improvement in the expertise within our politicians around our education system, because it has, since academisation has meant there's been a complete lack, and they've let go of understanding the system, and we're beginning to see now what happens as a result of that.
Do you think there's ever a temptation to put someone in a post that doesn't necessarily understand very well what they're doing?
That person given them that post would need to know that they don't really know, mm-hmm. and that they're doing that deliberately. But the thing is that having that post, I mean, that was a created post. It didn't exist, did it, before Marvin Rees got into power. He created this post, and what it does is it gives him a buffer, because he doesn't have to answer the questions about that SEN budget. Yeah, I mean, 5 million, it wasn't that 5 million deficit. has been around for years. Yeah. It wasn't unknown about. This is an some of this is cumulative. Some of the reasons why it's grown in the last couple of years.
This city has let its kids down. Special needs kids down, completely
and utterly. Absolutely.
I mean, it's well done, everyone that's sort of made them pull their socks up and actually do what they are supposed to do by law and educate these children.
You've got to take into account the national picture. And what happened was that the free school set up, loads of free schools have basically lost loads of money. Many of them have failed after having spent millions, and there was a hole in their budget. So what the Tory government did is they raided the special needs budget to prop up the free schools. And that basically is subsidising middle-class parents who've got basically academic children at the expense of special needs kids with special needs.
Anyway, against all of this, we've got something called the Children's Charter. That was also announced by the mayor this year. Any idea if that's going to be anything important?
It's words on a page. I mean, what does it actually mean? It's people signing some words. That literally was in the press the day before the High Court. The judge gave the decision in the High Court. I mean,
looks like fire brigade management. But anyway, what do you think, Joe, about the future now? Because, I mean, going back 2 or 3 years, the city was, even then, was being told when we're not educating our children as well as other cities around the country, comparable cities as wealthy as we are. Are things looking up or what?
Well, I can't speak for other cities. All I know is, as Martin's already pointed out, the money that we get for education has gone down, and also the control's been taken away from the local authority. I mean, how many secondary schools are not academies or free schools now?
Sir Mary Redcliffe is the only one who's left in the local authority.
And there's no control. I mean, quite a lot of the primary schools have gone in.
Just under half of the primaries.
And what I do find is, it's all very well and good holding the council responsible, whoever's in power. But the reality is, it's Tory. It's a Tory kind of ideology that's caused this. The less money you've got, the easier it is to make mistakes. I mean, you can look at anybody.
We've obviously got a few bob left because they're still talking about building this arena. Now, quite whether there's going to be how much local authority money is going to be going into it, of course, is another question. This week in the Bristol Post, whether it's true or not is, who knows, could be fake news. Could there be a third Bristol Arena location under consideration, says Esme Ashcroft at the Bristol Post this week. Excuse me, Temple Island or Filton Airfield. Feels like every Bristolian has an option where the city's long-awaited arena should be built. But is there a third option? A council source has told the Bristol Post the authority's looking at the Bristol Fruit Market in St Phillips as a potential site for the much-anticipated concert venue. Now, this has been dragging on for probably something like nearly 20 years, Joe. Hopefully, next week we'll have a decision. Do you think we'll know? And if so, will the right decision be made?
Well, it depends on what you mean by decision, because you have to remember that Marvin can't decide to build an arena at Filton. That is not his decision to make. The only thing, as far as I know, he can do is decide what the planning, the current planning status of the site by Temple Meads, which is currently designated as a site for an arena, could be withdrawn. And therefore, someone else could apply for planning permission to build an arena on another site. As far as I know, that's all he can do.
It's South Gloucestershire, isn't it?
It's not actually technically in South Gloucestershire. It's very close to the border.
Right on the edge.
Yeah.
Where would you like it to be?
Definitely not. Definitely not in Filton. I don't agree with it going there. I suppose I've got some reservations about that company anyway. And I was in the scrutiny, oversight management, scrutiny management board meeting, the 10.5-hour meeting that heard the evidence and heard Colin Skellett say that Filton was only 5 minutes away from Bristol, And that's central Bristol.
Well, does he have some sort of rocket car?
Well, I did wonder, and there's an and with no mention at all about the south of the city. I do understand the arguments, the economic arguments about the Arena Island site. The problem is you could apply those arguments probably to any site, really. It's just, I suppose, the main thing is it's prime real estate, and they've done their calculations and they reckon they can generate more income for the city with this sort of mixed use development. And I don't actually have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is siting an arena right by an out of town shopping centre, which is going to take away even more business from our city centre. That to me is a real worry.
The obvious thing is transport. If people are coming by car, having it near the motorway is a much, much better, rather than getting people from, I mean, you're talking about dragging people into the city from maybe 50 miles around. Doesn't it make it sensible to put it near a motorway rather than Temple Meads?
Yeah, but that motorway goes across North Bristol. It's nowhere near the south, and so anybody who's travelling from the south is going to have to drive, and that's going to, well, it's going to reduce the opportunities for people in the south of the city, and it's also, and the east really, and also it's going to increase congestion. And we're supposed to be carbon neutral by 2050, and we're supposed to be making progress in that area. I can't see how that will help at all.
Oh, apparently Metrobus will save the day. It'll be sucking all that nasty pollution out, although I still haven't seen one.
I saw one. I actually did see one the other day.
Oh dear. Anyway, so let's just move on to discuss, because there's somebody called Liz Lation I managed to track down this week. She's a Lib Dem councillor down in Somerset County Council. Everyone is kind of biting their nails down there. The employees have been told, would you please go on to a 3-day week? And they are next in line, apparently, to go bankrupt after Northampton. They've got the least reserves. The only county council in the country which has got less was Northampton. And amazingly, Somerset councils have been doing things like investing in shopping centres. Now, I would have thought a shopping centre is not the greatest thing to invest in right now, since we've got charity shops moving into the galleries. We've got House of Fraser that nearly went bust in Cabot Circus last week. The incomes that you're going to get from those is going through the floor. So not the best place to put your money. But anyway, Liz had some points to make to me, and I'm hoping to have her in a few weeks' time to discuss some of this, where are our councils putting our money. Here she talks a bit about where to invest, and she thinks investing in services is the best thing to do. So let's have a listen to Liz now from Somerset County Council. She actually lives down, I think, in Street.
If you go back to after the Second War, when lots of housing had to be built, presumably, I don't know, but I presume that government and local authorities were borrowing money to build then, but they had the house. Do you know? I mean, if somebody moved out of the house, they still had the house. You still have the asset. If a council invests in a commercial operation, a commercial company, and they put capital monies into that, and then that commercial company goes bankrupt, what happens then to the public money? It just disappears. Some of it might go to creditors, but it just disappears. And then the council will still have interest repayments and eventually the repayment of the loan to cover, and nothing to show for it.
And she's making quite a good point there, Martin, isn't she, that councils seem to be seeing themselves increasingly as kind of speculating and businesses, whereas if you put your money into something that doesn't give a return, you could even end up with nothing to show for it and still having to pay the interest on the original loans.
Well, what's happening is we've got elected mayors, which is a Tory idea, going around saying that they're going to build arenas, undergrounds, but meanwhile, what we aren't telling you is that we can't do the basic stuff which you always used to do, which is providing housing, schools and toilets. And this is because, of course, we had 13 years of Labour government and they didn't release local authorities the power to create social housing. And this is a political decision. The decision was made in the 1980s, we're going to get rid of social housing. And that's what they've done. And of course, that's why we've got a homelessness crisis, because we haven't done any of the things we should have done, which political parties across the spectrum did automatically. The people who built the most council houses were in fact the Tories in the 1950s, and they were quite happy to build them at that stage. And selling them off at less than market value to the current tenants basically is giving free money to those people, and it also then undermines the whole basis of the and it's got macroeconomic implications as well, because you then get housing bubbles which pop, which crash the economy, which ruin exports and the manufacturing sector. So we've done loads of stupid stuff for 30 years, and now we're staring down the barrel of a gun.
The government's £100 million plan to eradicate rough sleeping, we heard all about this week. It was trumpeted on, I think it was Monday, on the BBC. Let's start the week with something great, £100 million. But the minister admits that the £100 million is not new money. It's just been reprioritised from existing budgets in his department. I mean, I don't know how they managed to name some of these ministers, but this guy's James Brokenshire. Do we think that, Joe, do you think that there is going to be actually any turnaround in this? Because I'm fed up with seeing people having to sleep rough in the city.
I mean, I suppose there's homelessness and there's rough sleeping. I mean, rough sleep. There's a lot of rough sleepers that are probably not actually ready to be housed, in the sense of the people that are living in temporary accommodation. They need help and they need support in other ways. It's not an area that I know a lot about, but it does seem that a lot of their problems are around mental health. So maybe some of them have issues with substance abuse. And if you don't deal with those problems, how are you going to get them into some kind of like normal life? And I think the problem with
They can have it be in a hostel where they're looked after
only if they feel safe. Only if they feel safe, because the problem is, my understanding is, a lot of people are refusing to go into hostel accommodation because they actually feel like it's more dangerous than being on the streets, and that is quite frightening.
It probably costs money to make those hostels less dangerous, maybe having more staff in there, sort of thing.
It does come down to people most of the time, doesn't it? Really does. And actually, people cost a lot of money, and that's where £100 million probably won't go very far, really.
Martin, do you think we're going to see any change here? They say by 2020, hopefully this £100 million, which has been reallocated, will... I mean, they're saying it's going to end rough sleeping, but I wonder.
Well, we've had a massive increase in registered homelessness since the introduction of Universal Credit. And one of the things that Universal Credit does is, if you make a claim, you can't get any money for the first 5 weeks, it is now, which means people are immediately put into rent arrears and they have to go to Wonga or worse just to get through that 5 weeks. And then, this is a perfect storm. And I think nothing's going to change until the housing market crashes, possibly as a result of a run on the pound because of Brexit, and then we'll face up to the fact that with most of the resources in this country which are tied up in housing should in fact be invested in industry, and we haven't actually done that for 30 years. And we had a Labour government for 13 years, I have to say this, who didn't change the rules for local councils so that they could build council houses. So understand, we know what the Tories' game is. They want to get rid of council housing and social housing altogether.
The
Labour government didn't change the rules.
Martin, we've had an announcement this week that unemployment in the UK is now as low as it was in 1973. It's never been so low. So what is going on that so many people are homeless? I suppose they're not necessarily on those unemployment figures. And also, that another major, major problem is that rents are going up where real wages are falling.
Yes, and of course, 1973 was a big change in the international global capitalist economy, the OPEC price rise and so on. And I remember the headlines in 1973, because I was old enough to remember, unemployment over 1 million. What will happen next? Riots in the streets. And in actual fact, unemployment in this country has never dropped below 1 million since 1973. But from 1945 until 1973, it was always less than 1 million people unemployed. Now, in other words, we've now gone back to normal of 1973, but it's on the basis of quantitative easing and interest rates on nearly zero. Well, that just allows property prices to rise, which keeps everybody thinking that the economy is running along. And of course, we're actually running on empty, and pretty soon we're going to hit the wall.
There's a journalist called Jim Edwards who works for something called The Business Insider I came across this week. Well done, Jim. Great big pat on the back for you. A fantastic article, which I'll put up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. Unemployment in the UK is now so low, it's in danger of exposing the lie used to create the numbers, he says. Government statistics put unemployment at just 4.5%. But the real rate of unemployment is at least four times that, he says. He walks you through in this article evidence that shows why the official numbers are so misleading. Economists Danny Blanchflower and Richard Clegg of the Office for National Statistics challenged the article. And there's actually another, so we'll put a link to that one too. The ONS also produced household data suggesting the true rate of unemployment is three times greater than the government's preferred statistics. So I'll ask all three of you, actually, including you, Christine, where do you think these hidden unemployed are hiding? Any idea?
Well, I think that some of them are groups of people that, for whatever reason, are not allowed to be, that they're not technically declared as being unemployed, because they don't get job seekers allowance. They might get other types of allowances. So there's that group of people. There's also going to be people that kind of aren't part of the disclosed economy, and they're kind of under the radar. But unemployment has always been counted in different ways.
Say, does that include things like drug dealers, people who are now working for organised crime? I mean, they won't be on the unemployment figures.
Well, and I can't imagine that they're kind of claiming unemployment benefit either. Can you?
Well, maybe.
Well, I mean, maybe they are.
I would.
You know, they're going to have. In order to do that, you've got to demonstrate that you're actively looking for work, you've got to come up with applications that you've put in on a kind of weekly basis. And I doubt very much whether people that are actively employed in kind of what would be deemed within the law to be criminal activity are going to be in that position.
One of the things that he points out in this article is that one of the real one of the ways it's obvious to see that there isn't really this low level of unemployment is that Britain, Martin, has no wage inflation. Now, what does he mean by that?
Well, that's right. If there was full employment, you'd expect wages to start rising, but they haven't. And that's partly because there's been a change of power in the labour market. I mean, you know, unions don't have any power these days. And there's a lot less sickness at work because people are terrified of losing their jobs. Both unemployment statistics are manipulated and the inflation rate is also manipulated. And that's important that the inflation rate's manipulated, because that's how you measure the increase in the size of your economy. And if the inflation rate is bigger than they claim, and I would say that it is, because they constantly keep changing it and fiddling it, that means in actual fact the economy might not be growing at all. So, and what we've got is a situation where people are working in crummy jobs for less than they could probably get on benefits. I would put myself in that sort of position personally, and I think that the welfare of the society hasn't improved at all, and that's why there's an enormous resentment about the inequality in this society, even though unemployment is supposedly down. And as I said before, it's all based on zero interest rates and quantitative easing, which never used to happen.
Well,
and of course at some point that will have to be paid for.
I mean, that's not 2008, capitalism died.
Well, basically, it did. Yes, I mean, we've had quantitative easing. It was supposed to be a
printing money, by
temporary
the way.
Measure.
Listen, this is what they called printing money in the '70s, and they said Harold Wilson wasn't allowed to do it.
Well, indeed, and of course, when they've done it now to keep the financial services sector afloat. So after Brexit, there was another great dollop of quantitative easing from Carney. Now, everybody, it's very good for those who own assets like houses, or people who own even more assets like the Duke of Westminster. But of course, it's just money for nothing for those people.
Okay,
but
super.
For the ordinary folk, it's actually just storing up trouble.
Super,
and when, of course, it's going to unwind, and then we will see what the unemployment figures look like then.
For the super rich. Anyway, Joe, so the real unemployment rate, which the BBC did not announce, according to Business Insider, is actually more like 18%.
Well, I suspect it depends on when you measure it, because bearing in mind that I can't remember what the percentage is, but quite a lot of people in this country are on zero-hour contracts, and therefore technically they might be employed, but they might not have any income. And that's really difficult. I mean, I think that was one of the reasons that Universal Credit was brought in, and it's been a pretty much failure. Because it doesn't take into account the fact that people don't know what they're going to earn from one week to the next. I'm sure Martin's familiar with the ragged trouser philanthropists, but I do remember one of the things their mantra was plenty of work. That actually having a job was more important, was really important. But then they realised actually it was about the quality of the work more than anything else, and that takes us back to the miners again. The fact that there's such low skill jobs, and people are reliant on the goodwill of their employer to make sure they actually have any money coming in. And I think that's actually really frightening. I think it's something that we have to try. And I mean, you know, I would scrap them personally, 0 hours.
Okay, so let's have a look at, I mean, I'm tempted to just completely ignore it because there's so much nonsense and fake news spoken about it, but this is Jeremy Corbyn is laying a wreath at the site of the Munich terrorists. Now, there's been actually a complaint put in, apparently, to the press, or whatever they are these days, the Press Complaints Commission, about this. But Martin, I've also been reading that there were 8 Munich terrorists and none of them were buried at the Tunis ceremony, cemetery which Jeremy Corbyn visited. I mean, this does sound as if this has been going on all week. Channel 4 News and all the major newspapers saying that effectively he's laying a wreath at the site of the Munich terrorists. Even Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli president, has been weighing in, saying Jeremy Corbyn should, I don't know, resign, whatever, that this is a terrible thing that he's done. But what has he actually done?
Well, as you pointed out in the article that you sent me, there were 8 terrorists involved in the Munich in 1972, incident in 1972. 6 of them, I think 5 of them were killed by the West German police. The other 3 were assassinated. The 2 of them were assassinated by Mossad, and one of them's still out there somewhere. The people in the cemetery are people who were supposedly they weren't the actual terrorists. They were people supposedly linked to the terrorists, even though they denied that they were. And in other words, what Jeremy Corbyn was doing was laying a wreath, and there was a Liberal Democrat peer and a Tory peer at the same event or the same conference that he was at some year 2014, and it was to remember the 1985 air attack which killed 85 people, including 12 civilians and most of the leadership of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Now, is that a terrorist act or not a terrorist act? Of course, this is an aeroplane.
But this is interesting.
If you've got an aeroplane, then you're not a terrorist.
Martin, the interesting thing here is
terrorists are people without aeroplanes.
The interesting thing here is Benjamin Netanyahu weighing in on this because it was his attack.
Well, indeed, that's right. And of course, this is all being orchestrated from inside the Israeli embassy. We know this because that Mossad officer was caught out by Al Jazeera saying, "Well,
you're talking about the political attaché Shai Massot."
That's right, yeah. And he was a close associate of the head of the Jewish Labour Movement, which is the organisation which is making the most fuss about what Jeremy Corbyn did or didn't do. And of course, what Jeremy Corbyn has always been is a supporter of Palestinian rights. And of course, there is a question whether the state of Israel should be recognised by the United Nations because they're not within the borders that they were given in 1948.
So let's
and
just
never shown any attempt to that they were going to stay within the borders.
So
that
let's
they were
just
given.
Ask Joe Sargent: is Jeremy Corbyn your leader? Is he an anti-Semite?
No, he's absolutely not. It's a smear. It is a smear. I mean, there are probably definitely people in the Labour Party that do say things that can be construed as anti-Semitic, and there's no doubt about that. But the Labour Party's really come down like a ton of bricks on people, but it's still not enough. And the irony is that, you know, Netanyahu is, he's the same party as Menachem Begin, who was apparently involved in this King David Hotel bombing, and also
which killed a load of British soldiers, didn't it?
Came over and spent over and visited Margaret Thatcher and had tea with Margaret Thatcher, and obviously some Margaret Thatcher's got a few chums as well who have been involved in questionable activities like Pinochet. So it's the association, it's the guilt by association. And then of course the biggest irony is it's being put out by the Daily Mail, which of course supported Hitler during the Second World War. So
yeah, certainly
well, shirts in the 30s
in the run up and Hitler in the 30s make no bones about that. Martin, finally, Tommy Robinson, you sent me an article saying something about that the whole thing's a psychological operation. He's a sort of budding Ernst Röhm.
We haven't got a lot of time. English Defence League and Al-Majah Haroun appeared exactly simultaneously in Luton after the Royal Anglian Regiment marched through Luton. So Al-Majah Haroun suddenly appeared, and EDL also appeared. I think they're both front organisations for the intelligence services.
Why?
because that's the sort of thing the intelligence services do if you know the history, Tony. The Gladios, the networks
of
NATO.
What do you make of Tommy being arrested and then let off?
I think this is all part of a psychological warfare operation to turn him into a sort of a martyr. He's being... you can see the far right in the US. I mean, one of Trump's people actually said, what's happening to Tommy Robinson?
Budding Ernst Röhm. Yeah, of course. Budding Ernst Röhm, if you ask me. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Labour Councillor for Avon Mouth and Lawrence Weston, Joe Sargent, and also to Christine Townsend from Counter Colston. Join us after the news.
And on your mobile, BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.